Hello, and welcome to Barks Remarks, the podcast where we talk about the stories from the legendary Carl Barks, creator of Scrooge McDuck and writer and artist of the greatest Donald and Scrooge comics of all time. This episode is a 10-page podcast all about one of his short stories. Get ready to enjoy our remarks. Welcome back to Barks Remarks. I'm Mark Severino, a grown man who loves duck comics and loves learning something from those comics. It almost feels like giving them short shrift to call them educational stories. But these two stories are very engaging and very exciting to talk about, and you might just learn a little something from them. But first, before we get into the stories, I'm delighted to welcome a returning guest. I've got Veikko Suvanto chiming in from Finland today. Welcome to you. Welcome back, Veikko.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Last time you were on, we got to talk about a really cool Carl Barks adventure. I guess literally cool because it was a cold bargain. And that one was just kind of a good yarn, a great adventure story that had a little bit of real world intruding on it in kind of the Cold War background. But today we're doing something much different. It is two adventure stories, and they kind of share a little bit of a theme. Tell us, what are the stories that we're going to be talking about today, Veikko?
Right. So now we'll be discussing two 10-pagers. The first one is The Runaway Train, which originally appeared in late 1956. You probably have the exact dates. And then the second story is Gyro's Imagination Invention, which is another 10-pager that appeared in early 1957. So right. they're pretty much contemporaneous with the Cold Bargain story out of that. And I think that one was also from 1957.
Yeah, that's right. All of the stories that you and I are discussing are going to be from around this little era, which is maybe a little bit past what most fans would consider Barks' golden age, but is still a very strong point when he was churning out some really great tales and 10-pagers. You know, this is one of our episodes that's the 10-page podcast. That means it's a little bit less researched, and I changed the structure around a little bit. But you know, there's still going to be some interesting things to discuss for this one. So I'm going to note, let's see, I think that just saying the titles doesn't necessarily do either of these stories justice, right? Because for a lot of duck fans with the 10-pagers, they didn't originally have titles. They've been retitled. So it probably helps to like give a little bit of context. The Runaway Train, that title is pretty obvious. It's pretty evocative, but fans would know it as the story where Huey, Dewey, and Louie have to help with a train disaster kind of remotely while watching the news hour. And then Gyro's Imagination Invention, I don't know if that is one that would immediately leap to people's minds, but probably the biggest hook of the story is that it's the one that plays around with the idea of size and scale, and it does it in a really enchanting and engrossing way. And full disclosure, that is the story that you and I are the most animated and excited to talk about out of these two very educational Barks 10-pagers, right?
Yes, very much so. And I was actually surprised to hear that it's so little known, because for me it's like one of the definitive 10-pagers, one of the earliest that I remember reading, or maybe even having read to me by my grandfather or someone. And it's also a big favorite one of mine from this late period of Barks, the late 50s. I would rank it like at the very top of the 10 pages that he did in this period. Although you're right that I mean, just looking at this Fantagraphics volume where both of these stories are reprinted, it was a pretty strong period for Barks. There were a lot of other classic tales, like the one about the giant flowers and a few others that I remember also very well. But I think the Imagination Invention is still my favorite from this period.
Yeah, it's always a risk, Vaiko, that like a fan might consider a story that they happened to read early on to just be a classic because they're so exposed to it. And that's how I feel about this one, because I did read this one very early on. It was part of one of the Gladstone albums that collected in ancient Persia. So I read those a lot, and I naturally would continue to read the 10 pagers, which packaged Super Snooper with that story. Yeah. But, you know, it has such a unique place. But anyway, I should put a pin in it because we are going to start out by talking about the other of the two stories, The Runaway Train, which I think is going to be a really interesting one. Really briefly, Vaiko, you mentioned, just to digress a little bit, you mentioned, you know, having these stories read to you by your grandfather. It's been a little while since you came on. That would be, I just wanted to note that you are a longtime Carl Barks fan, right? That is kind of your credentials. I can't remember which stories you might have named as your favorite last time you came on, but it was probably an adventure story. So maybe before we begin, do you mind mentioning one or two of your like all-time favorite 10 pagers? That's something I like to ask people to share.
Yeah, actually, I don't think I named an adventure story, but I did name one of the longer stories. It was Letters to Santa, which is one of the rare comical stories that are longer that Barks did. So because we were recording just before Christmas, I thought it was appropriate, and it is indeed one of my very favorites. But the 10 pagers, that's really going to be a tough
one. I'm putting you on the spot.
I'm tough to pick just one. I mean, you know, I could go with the Hypno Gun that you did recently. I mean, that's at the in the very top five for me, or Pool Sharks. That's another one that I remember reading over at my grandparents, and it's a favorite of my grandfather as well. He always liked to read that one to me, and then it's of course a great story. And, lots of them. Wintertime Wager is another great one. The one with Gladstone Gander appearing for the first time.
Yeah. So, yeah. Very strong choices. So sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot there, but
No.
All right, so we're going to start out by talking about The Runaway Train. And you covered the fact that this was published in 56. It was December of 1956 that it was first published. And it was in Walt Disney's Comics number 195. For these stories, I like to mention the index score, the ranked community score, kind of at the outset. So this one is a pretty well regarded 10 pager. It has a score of 7.4 out of 10, which as of today is good for number 443 out of all nearly 43,000 Disney Comics titles. And then, Vaiko, probably the best way, though, to think about these 10 pagers is by, I've created a spreadsheet that plucks them into their own thing, and kind of, most fans remember the adventure stories much better. So I like to think about how do they rate compared to each other. This is a fairly well-regarded one. It is in the top 50, clocking in at number 50 on the master spreadsheet that I have here, out of all of his 270 or so 10 pagers. You know, so it's in the upper quintile. That's pretty good. I'll use the word quintile since we've got a math focused story here.
Yeah.
So we're not dealing with like one of the all-time classics, but we are dealing with a very well-regarded 10-pager. And it opens, it's kind of a prototypical opening for this kind of a story, right? So it has a little narrator box that talks about when it's stormy weather outside, Donald and the kids find things to do inside. And there's going to be this really big contrast between those things that they're doing inside. We've got Donald watching a quote mystery show, which is one of those like things that it's immediately coded as being nonsense and like quote bad TV, right? Something that is not edifying, not good for your mind. And we've got the nephews playing with their toy train in the background, but they're not playing with it in the usual way. We see them doing some sort of note-taking or some sort of calculation. And Donald, throughout this opener, Donald is extolling how great and exciting this shoot 'em up show is, while the nephews are talking about this, what ends up being a problem that they're trying to solve, where they've timed these two locomotives to miss each other at the switch. And they've been calculating kind of the speed and the distance and stuff. And Donald is watching a very tense moment of his program in the exact moment where the two engines crash with each other, sending him flying up to the ceiling. So, Vaiko, my impressions of this opener is that it's actually a very strong piece of setup. You get a lot of great coding and a lot of great information here. What do you think about it?
Yeah, I agree. Generally, I like the beginning, like the first half of the story, better than the second half. It kind of goes off the rails, as we would say, in the second half. But I do like this. The different ways Donald is drawn here, reacting to the TV show are just really great, especially in the third panel when he has his tongue sticking out and he's like waving to and forth in his coffee chair, and then he gets really excited. His hair or feathers stand up at this tense moment, and then of course the last panel when he crashes into the ceiling. I mean, that's just very wonderful.
Yeah, you're right. Donald's reactions are all very, very funny in this, to just watching TV.
Yeah. So it's also interesting. You mentioned about the contrast between the nephews and Donald, and it's like the almost complete opposite to the contrast that we will have in the second story that we'll be discussing, Imagination Invention, because here Donald is obviously this very man-child watching this this stupid TV show, and then in the second story he's like the grown up who only talks about these different scales and isn't interested in monsters or Martians like his nephews are. Nephews are still, you know, they're junior woodchuck selves in the second story. I mean, they're still checking things in their guidebook, but they are a bit more childish in the second story than they are here. This is like the nephews at their most advanced. We can discuss the rank that they have to reach with this measuring that they're doing. It's mentioned on the second page, and it's one of these abbreviations that or acronyms that Barks like to make fun of. In this case, it's SUEOTU, which stands for Supreme Unsurpassable Engineers of the Universe. So that's, I can imagine, it's a pretty high rank in the junior woodchuck hierarchy.
Right. So Barks loves to do that, like, hyperbole with the woodchuck titles, as you say, that this is all in service of getting this woodchuck Chuck rank solving this problem. It is interesting that he doesn't bother with an acronym that actually spells something here.
Yeah, that's right.
But this is, I think this is such a strong setup for the story, right? Because these 10 pagers, they have so little time to develop a cohesive narrative. And you really know almost everything, apart from the problem they're going to have to solve, you know pretty much everything about the story from the very get-go. And another thing that I really like about this story is that it basically takes place entirely in the duck's living room, right? Like, we're going to flash to different locations, but the main action is really going to be here with these two parallel things going on. Donald is not going to stop watching his television for the duration of this story, and the boys are going to be devoted to, first, you know, their little woodchuck scheme that they have to solve, and then when they get to see it play out on the real world, they're going to really be focused on that. And you know, Barks gets to really carry that through. So it'll be interesting. I'm curious to see where you think it goes off the rails, but I do like that it does have this really cohesive narrative here. It's kind of worth noting to me, I've been covering Don Rosa stories as well. This is kind of a typology that Rosa picked, I think. He almost froze this story in amber for his version of the nephews, the woodchucks, is very industrious. And Donald is this kind of slack about, really just interested in watching TV. I don't want to dwell too much on that because this is a Barks podcast.
You're probably right. I mean that's my impression of the Rosa stories, which I don't know as well as Barks stories. But he didn't really do this like a smart Donald or a responsible Donald as much as Barks did.
Right, and it's refreshing because we've talked a lot on this podcast about how Barks is very flexible. He adapts his characters for the story rather than the other way around. It's really in service of the story that he wants to tell. And so sometimes he bends his characters. He almost never breaks them, though, which is key. Yeah. They almost never deviate from what you would expect. Every once in a while, it can be a little distracting if the nephews become too naive. And maybe we can talk about if Donald is just too smart in that next one. But at any rate, we're going to see this play out. I don't want to go in too much into detail, but the nephews are over the next couple of pages, they're going to kind of recalculate and refigure their engineering problem here. Now I'm not an engineer, even though I look like one, but this strikes me that it's a very good representation, you know, onto childhood play of what a real engineer would do, right? They're playing out this little problem writ small. They're making their necessary adjustments. They're checking their calculations and figures and trying it out. I really like the next couple of pages, right, where Donald keeps entreating them to join him and watch the show. There is a part in his show that's gonna parallel what they're doing, where the crooks have, quote, shot their way out of the bank and stolen a locomotive for the escape. He's insisting that there's going to be a crash, but on their second try, the nephews are of course referring to their own toy train, saying no, there's not. And we get on by the third, I guess it's the fourth page, we get to see Donald's show result in a pretty spectacular crash. But in fact, the two engines miss each other at the switch on the nephew's toy set. So the two sets of characters are, you know, excited about different things. And Donald is confused because, quote, this is an important thing. He says, oh, never mind. I see that you don't even know what's going on in the world, as they've just ignored the exciting moment on his TV show in favor of their like real world experiment. Some pretty engaging, pretty cool setup, these first four pages, right? Any thoughts, any moments you want to call out there?
Yeah, it's really great that Donald is so oblivious to what the kids are doing, that he doesn't even notice that they are playing with toy trains. I mean, he sort of faintly acknowledges that they're playing with some kind of toys and not interested in his TV show. But when the nephews say that they didn't crash, he's like completely baffled. What on earth are you kids talking about? They did crash. Because he's so absorbed in his TV show. So yeah, I mean, up to this point, and maybe the next page, I think the story, or the next two pages, it goes progresses just fine. But the moment when it gets off the rails for me is maybe when Uncle Scrooge makes the appearance, because I think you said very well that what the nephews are doing with the train, all the calculations and all that is presented very plausibly. But then the solution that the nephews and Uncle Scrooge come up with for this real life collusion is sort of so implausible. I mean, I'm not expecting like a complete plausibility from these stories, but it's such a huge contrast to what was going on in the first part of the story. It doesn't completely ruin the story for me, but I would expect something a little better. So maybe we can move on to the
Sure, yeah. I will note that the splash panel with Donald watching the TV, it's notable to me that it seems to be in black and white, at least in the printing that I'm looking at. So that's something that reminds me of the, you know, the time span of this. So in that moment, we get one of these, like, again, this kind of reminds you of the time that we're in, one of these breaking news moments where you could kind of count on everyone to be watching almost the same thing on TV. The TV announcer solemnly intones that they're looking for Professor Brainwiz, the great mathematician, because only he can save hundreds of lives in the next few minutes. And they note that there is a situation where two trains are sharing the same track headed for each other, and that only this brilliant man can do the necessary calculations to solve the problem, to somehow save these trains. It's worth noting that, you know, the weather is at, that Barks has alluded in the beginning that the weather is really bad. And so he lists all these figures. The limited speed uphill is 60 miles per hour, less ice slippage of 8.64%. Headwinds of 50 miles per hour will be met for 12 miles below Blue Canyon, et cetera, et cetera. It's all the figures that engineers would theoretically need to solve this problem. And the nephews start to jot down the figures. And boy, I love how stressed the news announcer looks as he's reading them off. And we, again, we get this contrast where Donald wants to turn this off because it's gotten really boring. And the nephews beg him not to, but he says, "I'll be doggoned if I see why. There certainly is no Professor Brainwiz in this house." And the rest of the story is basically going to be devoted to proving him wrong there. It's interesting, right? What is Professor Brainwiz up to?
Yeah, so he's in his mountain cabin and pacing around thinking, what a time to be snowbound in my mountain cabin with the telephone lines broken down. So the telephone lines are broken down, but apparently he's somehow aware of this. I guess he could watch television or at least listen to the radio at his mountain cabin. So then he's thinking, but I couldn't have worked that problem anyway in so few minutes. Why don't they feed it to the 12 million electronic brain at the army base? And then in the next panel, we get a nice view of this electric brain.
Right. This is Barks referring to the giant computers of this age, right? They usually, in a few stories, Scrooge himself owns an electronic brain. It's hopelessly,
right.
It's very quaint and very cute. And of course, their train is out of commission. So, you know, the nephews are super excited to try and solve this, to see if they can work it as fast as Professor Brainwiz. But really what this is one of those stories where Barks is just shamelessly pandering to his young readers, empowering them, saying, look what kids can do. It's real catnip for child readers, right? And ultimately, you know, what happens is the nephews are going to solve the problem. Right, we get these cuts to the TV station where they're waiting for the professor's call, and when they hear that it's just some kids, Huey, Louie, and Dewey Duck, that say they know exactly where the crash will be, the men do not take them seriously, right? Again, this is a little bit more pandering because children are accustomed to not being taken seriously by grownups. So why don't you tell us, because you had referenced Uncle Scrooge, why don't you tell us what they resort to?
So the kids call Uncle Scrooge and tell him, Uncle Scrooge, did you hear about the train wreck? And then Scrooge says, yes, I wish there was something I could do to prevent it. Then the nephews present him with their bright idea. And the idea is to load these rubber mattresses into a fleet of helicopters. And there are these two guys observing it, saying, is the old duck wacky? They don't understand what he's doing. And then Scrooge somehow, and this is where it gets a bit too implausible for me, manages to go to the exact spot where the nephews have calculated the crash to occur at 10 seconds past 9:52 p.m. and drop all these mattresses into the rails at the exact spot in the exact right position so that they soften the crash. And then we get the second really great splash panel in this one with one of the best sound effects in any Barks story. I don't know, how would you pronounce that?
I you're right, that is a great onomatopoeia. I would pronounce it Scoweesh. It is a wonderful splash panel. It's the only reason I can think of why, you know, people really, I think this is a pretty well-known 10-pager. This splash panel is probably what people are picturing. I think it works a little better than you do because, you know, comic book logic wise, but I agree with you. If you look at it and you think about it, those helicopters are in a convoy. Helicopters cannot safely fly that close to each other in these conditions. Right. It doesn't, the pictures of how many they're dropping don't match that mass. But, you know, I think we're meant to go with it. And I guess maybe another problem is that it should, from a narrative point of view, it really should be matching the switchback aspect of their problem solving, right? If you want to be really picky. Right. I mean, they have to, both of them involve calculations, so that's consistent. But anyway, it's a very absorbing and animating splash panel, and I really do like it. And it wraps up, you know, with the nephews and Don, the nephews waiting for another news flash about the wreck, because that's the only way they can get confirmation. There's no such thing as a cell phone where Scrooge can just reach out to them. And they say, you know, the news comes on and confirms that the nation's thanks go to Scrooge McDuck and his brave pilots for dropping rubber mattresses, and thanks go to Huey, Louie, and Dewey Duck, whose brilliant figuring told the flyers exactly where the engines would meet. There's a very cute panel of them blushing furiously and Donald being confused. And it just wraps up with Donald kind of despairing that he didn't get to get in on these heroics. And they kind of pander a little bit to his sense of pride by saying, well, you know, if you weren't watching TV, we wouldn't have seen that at all. So that kind of makes you a hero. And it just wraps up with this cute panel of him going right back to his show about triggers and about G-Men and the shoot 'em up. It's a pretty solid ending, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I like the ending, the one with Donald just finding it. That's very good.
Yeah, so Vaco, I definitely see your criticism about the story. I agree with it. I think it could have been stronger, but I am glad that we got that great splash panel out of it. You know, the most memorable 10 pagers tend to be the ones that have some of these great splash panels. And this one has a couple of pretty strong ones that do help it stand out. I also do think that this one is just very strong from a narrative point of view. It's neat to see the kids being featured as the main characters. We don't often get that. And I really like that it's got kind of a cool theme here about just the power of knowledge, right? This is very educational. It is the application of learning that Bark seems to be really interested in here. I think this is a neat little story, and I think it's positioned really well as far as what Duck fans think of it. It strikes me that, like, at the bottom of the top 50 is just about right. This is a very good, but maybe not all-time classic story. Any kind of overall thoughts about it from you?
Yeah, I mean, I would maybe rank it a bit lower myself, but you're right. I mean, it is well structured, and it's actually pretty rare for a 10-pager to have two splash panels as like this one. It may actually be one of the very few ones, if not the only one. I need to check out that. But in spite of that, I mean, although Bark's sacrifices like four panels for one, it is really dense. I mean, there are lots of action in it, in spite of I mean, technically taking place in this one location, Ducks being in their living room all the time. So yeah, I mean, in that sense, I agree that it's a very strong story. I mean, well constructed.
Yeah, excellent. All right. Well, I think let's move on to kind of the main show, the one that you and I are very excited to talk about. We are going to be discussing Gyro's Imagination Invention, which really makes it feel like a showcase for Gyro Gearloose, even though it's not. He's really just a plot device in this one. This one was also published in, this was published in April of 57, so just a few months later. And this was in Walt Disney's Comics number 199, and I get to rank a similar rank of 7.4. and is ranked as of now number 432 out of all of those comics. And then if I switch over to my spreadsheet that tracks only the 10 pagers. All right, so this one is very, very close in position. It's just a couple of notches down, just outside of the top 50, coming in at number 53, at least in the moment in time that I captured on Index. And it doesn't tend to shift around so much. So again, people who know this one, they do really like this one. It does have a very memorable hook. But I think you and I would probably argue that this is a very underrated story. We can get into why. I do think that it does have one part that isn't as strong as the rest of the story. But but for my part, the reason that this really stands out and demands conversation is because it is, you know, he's ventured into science fiction a few times, Vaiko, but this is like one of the only times, this might be the only time that he really did what I'm thinking of as like science fact, right? He's taking this just application of learning, this kind of scientific concept, the idea of size and scale and relative bigness in the universe. And he's just building a story around that because that is what he wants to explore. And I guess it's reasonable to criticize that maybe it doesn't make for a normal narrative, right? But to me, the outcome of this is just so eye-opening and so absorbing that I think it just demands your attention. And the art in this one is also going to be something to really talk about. The comic book writers and artists of this time and of almost any time, they rarely get as weirdly experimental as this. And it's a shame that Barks didn't feel like he could be this experimental more often, because it's to me such a striking story. What are your kind of thoughts before we get into the story itself on this one?
Yes, I mean, well, I basically agree with everything you just said. And it's true that this is like more of a, or it feels more like a science fact story, although you know, if you look at it carefully, it actually does have quite a bit of science fiction in it.
Yes. But
especially when I read it as a child, the way these different planets and even one star are presented, it was such a matter-of-fact way that it didn't even occur to me to question what Donald is telling there. I mean, I don't think I really believed that you know, you would have these giant insects and you know, everything 10 times larger on the different planets. But it somehow seemed plausible to me that if there was life on these planets, simply because they're so much bigger than Earth, then everything would be larger. I mean, it just made perfect sense. And then what's interesting is that, referring to what I said earlier about the contrast between Donald and the nephews, is that Donald doesn't really feel like a different character in this story, although he is very like matter of fact and adult here, whereas in the previous story he was like acting like a child. But I think this is something that children can also relate to with regard to their own parents. I mean, sometimes our parents, and maybe especially our fathers, are all kind of silly and childish, and then other times they're telling us all this neat stuff about the universe and being like very educational. So I think that this Donald could, you know, just easily hop from the previous story from in front of his television set and start telling this very matter-of-fact stories about the universe.
Yeah, exactly, because it's something that clearly is one of his special interests, right? It really fascinates him. Yeah. And again, we're gonna see this contrast between Donald and the nephews, but it's going to play out a little bit differently in this story where he is really focused on what interests him, the idea of scale and size in the universe. And they are very childlike with their imagination being fired by more science fiction tropes, you know, like crazy looking out of this world aliens and stuff. It's almost like the difference between the science fiction of, say, Star Wars and, say, 2001, where one of them is like much more grounded, but it's telling the sci-fi story. All right, so let's do this. The opener to me is especially absorbing. We do get a nice splash panel, although it's a silhouetted one, and the narrator box opens, and I have children, and I feel this acutely, so I appreciate this story differently as a parent now. But it says, one of life's little joys is explaining the stars to the wondering minds of children. And we've got the nephews, you know, who are not quite in their super knowledgeable woodchuck mode, asking about the bright star just setting in the west. And he's telling them that that's not a star, it's Jupiter, the biggest of the planets. And that spurs the nephews to ask about Jupiter's size. And Donald gives this really nice analogy, saying that it's as much bigger than our Earth as an orange is bigger than a pea. And the nephews ask, Do you suppose people live on Jupiter? And so Donald says, hardly. You know, he immediately dismisses it. He talks about how if they did live there, they would be whoppers. They would be about 11 times taller than Earth people. And a nephew asks, kind of disappointedly, is that all the difference there'd be in them, just size? And they go on to say, where's your imagination? And they kind of talk about all the fantastical ways that they could be different. And Donald really tells us about how this story is going to play out. He says, I don't dig that scaly creature stuff. I like to imagine life on the stars as being like ours, only bigger, much bigger. And the nephew says, how dull. Golly, Uncle Donald, you have a very common imagination. Vaiko, I read a lot more of that opening page than I usually would dialogue wise, but it's all very important setup because this is how the story is going to play out. Basically, it's going to be Donald and Barks proving over the next 9 pages that's just the concept of scale itself can be really fascinating and really interesting. So for that reason, I think it's achieving exactly what it sets out to do. And I like that setup panel with the stargazing very much. So as we move on to this story, we're going to get into the Gyro phase. He is not the main character, despite being the title character. We've got Gyro also doing some sort of stargazing. And he's talked about, he's heard the ducks talking about, you know, why don't we imagine something more interesting? Do you mind reading the piece of dialogue, the nephew's first piece of dialogue on that first panel, the second page?
Yeah, so one of the nephews says, if we could go up among the stars, I bet we'd see 10-legged Wiffenzookers with radar eyes and brains like adding machines. And Donald answers, oh, baloney, why go off the deep end? Why not imagine something possible?
So again, it's really reinforcing the difference in thoughts and that childlike wonder. And Gyro has heard the word imagine. Gyro is doing his own stargazing here and wishing that he had the nerve to imagine himself on one. And you know, the nephew wonders, why does that take nerve? And he's going to go on to explain that he has developed the imagination invention of the title. He sets up to them that you could, in fact, imagine yourself on the stars and it would feel like you're really there. So, you know, this is basically virtual reality, right, is what he has created here. But it's reading your thoughts. And the reason that Gyro doesn't have the nerve to do this is because he'd be worried about turning off his machine if his imagination ran away with them. But, you know, we're hand waving away that this should be safe for the ducks because Gyro will be there to throw the switch. So that's our premise. And we've got the ducks launching into it. And Donald is going to be the one who gets to wear the headset of like the main headset here. So the nephews have to experience his thoughts, but they don't get to, quote, control his thoughts here. So that's our setup. The nephews are dismayed that they're not going to get to control it and see like scaly creatures, but Uncle Donald can't imagine anything about stars except for the bigness. So what Donald is going to do is he is going to imagine that they are on the planet Jupiter. And Veiko, do you want to kind of take us into how Donald presents the planet Jupiter here?
Yeah, so on Jupiter, as one of the nephews says, it's a Jupiter as Uncle Donald imagines it, very plain with no frills. So it's just like the planet Earth, except everything is 11 times bigger, apparently. That's what Donald is explaining on the next page. Jupiter is nearly 11 times thicker through the middle than Earth, so its creatures and things are 11 times enlarged. And then we get the first of these critters who are going to make a return appearance a couple of times in the stories, the grasshoppers, who are now only pretty much the same size as the nephews. And they're just going by, and we are ka-thump-thump, and the nephews are of course, a bit scared.
It is very cool. The illustrations of the trees that are half a mile high, it looks really animating to me. But the nephews are just ho-hum bored. And It's worth noting that Barks is right here with the scale, you know, roughly 11 times is the same size. It's funny because in actual like science literature, science fiction, there's a great like tradition of imagining the weird creatures that might live in the gases of Jupiter. But of course, Donald is just imagining it as a solid planet, and we're just scaling up all the rules of gravity to just make it a bigger Earth. So that's the weird conceit that Barks is going to go with here. I admit that was a little confusing to me as a kid, because I was like, isn't Jupiter a gas planet? And it was hard for me to kind of wrap my head around what he was doing. But at some point, I went with it and was like, okay, everything is really, really big. And we kind of cut in, you know, to a different setting. There's a distant farm, so Donald just imagines them there. And we get to see the ducks around some different everyday farm things, a giant ear of corn, a cow's hoof that, you know, Louis initially thinks he's leaning against a rock. A laying hen sits on the nephews. It's very cute. And this is going to be where we essentially transition. The nephews are annoyed by having this hen set on them. So we're going to transition away from Jupiter. And now we're going to visit one of the stars. And this is clearly an imaginary star here. So the imaginary star that they're going to go to is Phonus Artichocus, which is 2,300 times bigger than the Earth. And again, we are going to do this thing with scale where we're going to just see the same setting, but much, much bigger, right? This is where it becomes really, to me, imaginative. Donald describes, you know, notice how much. Oh, the nephews say, this looks like the spot where we landed on Jupiter. But Donald says, notice how much bigger things are. The trees are 50 miles high, and those mountains across the way are 3,000 miles high. What else do they see here?
Right. So then they again hear some clump sound effects, and the nephews think that they might be some more of your grasshoppers. But Donald says that no, just some gnats walking by. So I don't actually remember how this was translated. What are these gnats? Like not houseflies, but
yeah. So these are gnats in the original English. Are you wondering if that's what they are?
No, I was wondering just what kind of insects they are, because they're so much smaller than the grasshopper.
Yeah, gnat is just like a little troublesome, almost like a fruit fly.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're a little bit, they're not drawn like the most realistic, but they're very funny looking. I think this is one of this next panel where Donald says, if you'd like to see a grasshopper, that is one's foot you're hiding under.
Right.
I love that. The towering grasshopper foot is a panel that always really got to me. And then the nephews point out there's a big waterfall near us. They should run over for a closer look, but it turns out they're 200 miles away. You know, Donald's really just hammering home all the aspects of size here. there are tiny little. Do you want to read the nephew's skeptical exchange with Donald there? He says, "What are you handing us?"
Yeah, so Donald answers, "The truth multiplied by 2300. Notice those bubbles floating around." "Yes," said nephews. "Whoever blew them must be as windy as you are." Well, then Donald says, "Poke
one of those bubbles." Let me interrupt. Mm-hmm. I love that exchange. I love that bit. That line to me is great. The truth multiplied by 2300. I think that is a great way to sum up this story. And what do the bubbles end up being?
They're drops of mist from the waterfall that the nephews thought was so nearby.
Right. So again, this is Donald's imagination right here. So the joke is basically going to be on the nephews throughout this one. And they transition back to that farm, which is now about 250 miles away. He says, "By our tape lines." That's a term I haven't really heard. I think that means like a measuring tape. Right. So at this point, the scenery looks a lot different. The ducks are hiding because the farm is being attacked by hostile Indians and they need to hide behind some cobwebs. You know, that's a little element that hasn't really aged well. The Indians, by all accounts, actually look like they're drawn relatively accurate, but of course it's depicting them as very, like, again, hostile. But the point of this is that the nephews are hiding behind what turns out to be cobwebs, and some large lumps that appear to be rocks are just motes, particles of dust kicked up by the hooves. And it's a very, again, animating, absorbing panel on the next page where they nearly get hit by an arrow that's two blocks long. So again, the nephews are starting to just show their astonishment at what scale can look like. And we're going to transition. It's very important that we get three of these story beats, right? And storytelling, yeah, to really impact, to make an impact, you need something to happen in at least threes, which is kind of the ideal storytelling number. So tell us about that third, the next transition, our third setting here.
Right. So next we're going to Betelgeuse, that big red star up there on the high shoulder of Orion. And there Donald says, "You'll see things that are really big stuff. Let's go."
Yeah.
So this is, of course, an actual star.
Right. Despite its very funny sounding name to most people's ears, it is, in fact, an actual star. And this is where things go, like, I was about to say off the rails, but really just they don't. They just, this is where things get truly spectacular, right?
Yes.
The enormity of the scale, I think he does such a great job conveying. We see the ducks standing on a massive pine needle. The kids want to see a grasshopper, so Donald points to one on a twig several miles below. And Donald has imagined, what has he imagined?
Yeah, so he's imagined this gigantic grasshopper that has five ocean liners on his back. So you can see how big he is. And the grasshopper is actually carrying the five ocean liners on his back. And this is the one panel that has really stuck in my memory the most from this story. The grasshopper just coolly carrying those ocean liners on his back. It's such a great panel. And then also the magnifying glass that allows us to see the nephews faintly on the pine needle in that panel.
Yes, exactly. This might be the, like, best panel. I think you're right. This is the one that I always remembered. It's a radical panel, and it's so nonsensical, right? Because it shows us, it really screams scale, because there's no reason for ocean liners to be on the back of a giant insect except to show off its size. And this is what he can imagine with Gyro's machine. Now we get this neat little moment here where the nephews are gonna, like, we're gonna be reminded that they are the clever junior woodchucks, because they consult their guidebook, which says that Betelgeuse really is this big. It would take Earth's fastest rocket ship 100 years to fly around it. I'm gonna suspect that might even be that's probably wrong. It would probably take uncountable years, but I don't know off the top of my head. And one of the nephews says, no wonder we feel small. That's what this story is meant to do, right? The story is meant to make you ponder the vastness of the cosmos and make you feel really small. And Vaiko, so much child's like science fiction kind of ignores the rules of space and space travel and shows people jetting around between planets mm-hmm. and the stars. And I think this, more than almost any other media I consumed, more than any bit of media that I consumed as a small child, is what convinced me and gave me this great idea and appreciation of the true vastness of space. Yeah, so this last part for me is the one bit that kind of, it maybe runs out of gas just a little. You know, they transition this time down to the farmhouse and they see that it is abandoned because they see a sign from 200 miles away on the farmhouse door. It's a quarantine sign. The farm has been quarantined for chickenpox, which is something that I had as a kid, which modern kids don't like know about because we've pretty much vaccinated it away. So there's a funny little age marker. And the nephews are like, oh man, let's get out of here. But Donald says, hold on, you wanted to see scaly creatures. And the nephews get attacked by these scraggly looking chickens that Donald calls chicken pox germs. So, you know, this is a fun little bit of nonsense, but it doesn't quite keep the same tone of the rest of the story. And I'm not sure that Barks had like the best way to transition back to Gyro, because at this point, Gyro is going to see how uncomfortable the ducks mostly are. Donald is kind of reveling in the nephew's discomfort here, and he turns the machine off and we get this nice little closer. That's a great bit of a reflection where the narrator Box, it's almost poetic. It says, so all of a sudden the ducks are back on Earth again. And the planets and the stars they see are mere specks of light far off in the great black dome of the sky. And do you want to tell us about the nephew's exchange with Gyro here?
Right. So the nephew say, it's great to not feel small anymore. And Donald says, I tried to show the boys a few things about the size of the stars, Gyro. Oh, that's too bad, says Gyro. Did he show you anything that took imagination, like scaly creatures with radar eyes? Phooey on scaly creatures, said the nephews. If any of those corny monsters bother us, we'll seek one of Uncle Donald's grasshoppers under them. So, yeah.
So I do like that closing exchange a lot. The nephews have been converted, mostly at least, to Donald's way of thinking. They are truly impressed by the scale and size of the universe. And we imagine we as the reader probably have been converted as well. I know that I have. So I guess I didn't mention, too, that every time Gyro is around, we have these very cute little moments of his little light bulb helper gambling around, catching fireflies, doing very fun stuff in the background. Boy, Vaiko, this story just, it fires my imagination today. It fired my imagination so much as a kid. I do think that little, you know, penultimate moment, it doesn't strike the same tone as the story. And that's like, for me, a mild criticism about the story. But on the whole, I find the story so incredibly unique, and I love it. I think this is at least a very close classic and certainly a personal favorite of mine.
Yes, I mean, I agree that those chickenpox germs are kind of anticlimactic in the story. You might expect that they would encounter one more giant insect or something like that. But I don't know. I mean, I kind of like it for that very reason. It's almost like a ending to a Shaggy Dog story, you know, where you have this long and convoluted story, and then this is some really lousy pun at the end. So this feels a bit similar. One interesting thing is that this pun, that they sort of look like chicken and they are chickenpox germs, doesn't translate into my native language, Finnish, because the chickenpox is called something different. It doesn't have the word chicken in it, but right. These germs were translated as foot and mouth disease germs, and somehow that also made sense to me, that that this disease would look like those scraggly feather horrors.
Right. Yeah, I can see it's very much a just go with it type of ending.
Yeah.
I think what I'd really like to kind of leave people with is that I think these are both a couple of very strong stories, but I really do want to go to bat for Gyro's imagination invention. Boy, I feel like if it had had a better title too, that it might be a little bit more memorable. When I was trying to remember the story, Vaco, but when I kind of began this podcast and was kind of like thinking, well, what are the 10 pagers that I'd like to give episodes to? It took me a long time to even find the story and which publication it was in, because I never knew it by a title. You know, I just knew it by the content. And I didn't really understand how to navigate Index quite as well at the beginning of this project. So there were a few weeks there where I was like, where is that story? Going through some of my old comics, trying to remember where it was. But anyway, I think it's worth going to bat for. I think it deserves to be remembered. Maybe not quite in the same breath as like some of the stories that you mentioned, like Pool Sharks and Wintertime Wager. And which you know are favorites of mine and are just all-time classics. But I think that this is a near classic, and it's just such a strong concept that it really deserves another look by Duck and Duck fans and Barks appreciators.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I absolutely agree. As I said, it's for me in the top tier of the later stories. One 10-pager I should have mentioned is sort of from the middle of Barks, like Golden Period and the later period, the one with the new neighbors. I think it's called Donald's Raucous Roll. In English, and that's one that I really really enjoy.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That is a great one. You know, you and I had kind of bandied about a couple of other stories to maybe pair with Gyro's imagination invention. I'm glad that we ended up going with the Runaway Train, because it is neat to talk about these two stories that really are focused on like knowledge. We had kicked around Stranger Than Fiction, which is a very fun 9-page story. It's a pretty late one. It gets a little bit silly, but it's much less concerned with like real knowledge than it's much more soft sci-fi rather than these I would call much more hard. It's not science fiction. I mean, I guess under the strict definition, yes, the Runaway Train sort of is an example of science fiction. What else did we consider? I think there were a couple. What are the other like pseudo-science-y ones? Oh, you know, I had talked about possibly The Moving Island. I didn't look too carefully into that one, but I think it kind of came across my mind as I was like thinking about these. Now, I think these two worked really well as a package. We get to see these two different versions of Donald. I think you made a good case, though, for how they do bend the characters, but they don't quite break them. These are really concerned with what animates the nephews in the realms of science and engineering and what animates Donald. And he is one of those people. This is Bart. Just really having fun with something that he is personally very interested in.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So I think we did a nice job. All right. Well, Vaco, I really appreciate you joining me to cover these great 10 pagers. Hopefully we managed to give this one a little bit of what we would consider much needed attention. And I would encourage people to check out the podcast on Facebook and sometimes on Instagram at Barks Remarks. And you can reach out to us at barksremarks@gmail.com and stay tuned for our occasional 10-page podcast episodes. Vaco, thank you again. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation. It was really great to have this conversation again.